the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you today live from Austin, Texas, here the capital of Texas. And in just a few moments, we're going to welcome as our special guest for a live interview segment here for the program, Professor Jay Bujyshevsky, who is professor of government and philosophy at the University of Texas and one of my favorite Christian authors and apologists. And you'll enjoy getting to know him, and we'll get to that conversation in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news. And on my website at albertmohler.com, you'll find an article published this morning about reading the Bible to older children, and especially this time of the year with people thinking about Christmas. And I've had several letters and emails, calls that have come into the program about good literature for young children. And in particular, a very interesting question that has come about Bible storybooks for children. I go back to what I talked about on Wednesday for very young children, particularly then for preschool children. You need to be sure that you don't just reduce the Bible to a set of morality tales, but rather put it in the context of the big story of God's purpose and his plan of salvation. But when older children come into view, you have new opportunities. And I was very glad to have people write in and ask for some special attention to school-age children. I published that article this morning, and in so doing, I recommended a resource, that is the Child Story Bible by Catherine F. Voss. And you can find the one-volume edition available from Erdmann's and a three-volume, that's the original edition, available from Banner of Truth Trust. You can find links to that at my website at albertmohler.com. But I mentioned in the course of this article 10 suggestions for parents about reading to children, and in particular reading Bible stories to children. Let me just suggest these to you, and then I would refer you to the article. You can find it at the website for your further consideration and share it with others. First, read at a specific time set as a part of the ritual of the child's life. Children thrive on structure. They're motivated by anticipation. Make a special reading time part of the family's day. The obvious time for this is bedtime, and for good reason. The child senses the end of the day is near, knows sleep is coming, and is more likely to be both calm and attentive. Furthermore, the child is more likely to anticipate a special time of closeness with mom and dad. At bedtime, dressed for bed and gathered with parents to end the day. There's nothing wrong with reading to the child at any hour of the day, but bedtime is undeniably special. Two, read in a clear voice and avoid both excessive drama and a lifeless reading. A listless and lazy reader will lose the child's attention, but an excessively dramatic reader will make the child grow accustomed to drama, often at the expense of thoughtful content and retention. You want the child to be fully drawn into the story, but you also want the child to be thinking about the story and its meaning. Third, when reading a Bible story, keep the child or help the child to find the actual text of the account in the pages of the Bible. Don't just read out of a Bible story book. Make sure the child knows how to find the story in the Bible. Read the story from the Bible. The child needs to learn to read the Bible itself, not just Bible story books, and to know that the Bible is God's perfect and sufficient word. Four, place the story in its context within God's plan and within the Bible. Help children to understand how every word of the Bible is fulfilled in Christ and finds its meaning within God's plan to redeem his people from sin. Five, recognize that many of the stories of the Bible teach a clear moral lesson, a lesson that children clearly need to learn and take to heart. At the same time, recognize that these accounts are never merely morality tales. Point your child to the big picture. Six, never read down to your children, treating them as dull. Instead, give them a substantial story, lay out the narrative, and then trust that they will want to learn and to push themselves towards understanding. Then, be the human agent of that understanding by explaining the story with patience, creativity, and insight based in the fact that you know both the story and the child or children hearing it. Seven, be as honest as the Bible in revealing the strengths and weaknesses of God's people. Children need to know that God loves us in spite of who we are as sinners, not because of our supposed worth. Children need to learn moral honesty and to know that all, even we, dear parents, are sinners. Eight, ask your children questions about the story to measure understanding and make sure to see if they have any questions. Ask questions the next morning, during the day, on the playground, in the car, and when the child is in the bathtub. Encourage conversation about the Bible and Bible stories. Nine, ask older children to help with the reading and to grow accustomed both to reading for themselves and to reading aloud. There is much too little reading of the Bible allowed to the congregation in many churches. Let the recovery of reading aloud the Word of God begin in your home. 10. Finally, teach them to pray the Scriptures, talking about the story just read and its biblical text as you pray. Pray that God will apply His Word to their hearts. Thank God for His Word and for His love. Remind them of Christ and His promises, and entrust them to God for the night and for eternity. You'll never waste a minute spent reading to your children, much less reading Bible stories and the Bible itself to your children. In issues in the news, you'll want to know that the Catholic bishops have approved a statement calling upon United States Catholics to exercise their faith in voting and in making decisions with the upcoming presidential election. As a matter of fact, one that is, I think, particularly interesting in this document is that the bishops came back to affirm what they call the intrinsic evil of abortion, and they encouraged Roman Catholics to pay heed to that particular issue in making their voting decision. As a matter of fact, they make clear that they endanger their souls in indeed trying to put into office someone who would hold a pro-choice or pro-abortion position. Now, evangelical Protestants do not have the same mechanism for speaking to these issues, and for good reason, for theological issues, and for theological reasons. But I would want to point out that I have respect when you have bishops here actually acting like bishops and insisting that there is a theological and spiritual accountability when it comes to the vote. It's not just a matter of choice. It's not just a matter of pragmatic consideration. It is a matter of principle. And I certainly want to agree with them about the intrinsic evil of abortion and the fact that Christians are accountable on that issue for our vote. The Financial Times is out with a very interesting article. Christina Freeland is reporting that we have a new generation of young people in the United States and around the world who actually do not seem to have any understanding of citizenship. They don't consider themselves to belong to any nation. They think of themselves as citizens of the world, or for that matter, citizens of the World Wide Web. She writes that they call themselves digital immigrants, digital natives. They're coming to age in an information era in which they think themselves basically just a unit unto themselves, personal autonomy being the main worldview that frames their existence. And they think that they happen to live in the United States of America or France or Bangladesh or wherever they call home, but they do not consider themselves natives. They don't consider themselves citizens. As a matter of fact, she cites here Noreen Chaudhuri Fink, 29, a U.S. and U.K.-educated daughter of Bangladeshi diplomats who lives in New York. She said she and her friends have coined the phrase cosmopolitan nomads to describe themselves. Now, I find interesting that this whole concept of citizenship is being redefined just before our eyes. But it certainly makes sense when you think about these young people who've lived in two or three different countries and can't imagine that they're going to call any one country home. I find it even more interesting that American young people who've only lived in one country, and most of them never having traveled to any other country, nonetheless feel themselves part of an international community even before they consider themselves Americans. Something for us to ponder as we look ahead. 1968, it's the cover story of Newsweek magazine, and for good reason. A pivotal year. Daniel Henninger, writing in the Wall Street Journal, suggests that it's just about time that we say goodbye to 1968. What he's talking about here is the massive political, social, and cultural revolutions that took place then. He mentions that if you consider what took place in 1968, it's hard to imagine how that year would not be pivotal. It was the year of the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour. It was the year of North Korea capturing the USS Pueblo. It was the year Senator Gene McCarthy defeated President Lyndon Johnson in the New Hampshire primary. It was the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, that Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated. It was the year that the Soviet Union occupied Czechoslovakia. It's also the year, of course, that Americans narrowly elected Richard Nixon over Hubert Humphrey to the American presidency. But what made 1968 so interesting in the United States and in Europe, particularly in France, was a spirit of revolution. And what Daniel Henninger and others are noting is that this spirit of revolution certainly affected a generation. It's interesting to note that several of the candidates for president in the 2008 race were college students or college age. They were either teenagers or young adults at the time of 1968. As a matter of fact, this entered into a conversation on the Democratic side just in recent days when Senator Barack Obama, speaking of Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, pointed out that he was too young to have been a part of all of that chaos, and that maybe it was time that the nation moved on. It is interesting for us to note that Newsweek magazine has taken account of this. You'll also find the article by Daniel Henninger at the Wall Street Journal. It is a reminder to us that what happens on college and university campuses eventually filters through the entire culture. This is the whole concept of the radicals of the 60s becoming the tenured radicals of our present day. It really does matter what happens on university campuses. That's where so much of the revolution and foment took place in 1968. And you won't be surprised to know that it's that way even now. We're taking advantage of the fact we're here in Austin, Texas, home not only to the government of Texas, but also to the University of Texas, one of the nation's great state universities. In just a moment, I'll be back with Professor Jay Buzyshevsky, who is professor of government and philosophy. He's one of my favorite Christian thinkers. You'll enjoy the conversation coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program. He's a man with a keen mind, a committed Christian who teaches on one of America's most elite state university campuses. My guest today is Professor Jay Buzyshevsky. He is professor of government and philosophy at the University of Texas. Jay, welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, I first came to know you through your writings. I'd be hard pressed to come up with where I first encountered your name. It may have been at First Things. I certainly remember appreciating your book, The Revenge of Conscience. The book written on the heart, The Case for Natural Law, when it first came out. But it's great to meet you.
Well, it's great to meet you too. I've known about your television, your radio program for quite a while, and this has transformed the public debate. It's good to be part of a conversation like this.
Well, it is an honor to be here in Austin and to be in conversation with you on your home turf. You do teach at one of the largest and I would suggest most influential public university campuses in America.
Well, it sure is big. Yeah, it's enormous. That can be a problem. You're in touch with a lot more people, and that's very nice in some ways. You have an opportunity to reach more people, to teach more people. But when the campus is that large, there's also a sense of enemy. You have to work harder in order to build community among faculty, among students, among any sorts of staff, any sorts of people who might be there.
Now, some parents are going to know you, and some college students especially, through your books entitled How to Stay Christian in College, An Interactive Guide to Keeping the Faith, first published in 1999. I think there's a new edition out, a Think edition in 2004. That's the kind of thing that speaks immediately to why I think a lot of people are surprised to know you're teaching at the University of Texas. Here you are, clearly identified as a Christian. And you're speaking as a Christian to these issues, and you're actually from the position of a professor's as chair speaking to students about how to stay Christian in college. Why would you do such a thing?
Well, I do such a thing largely because when I was in college, my Christian faith was completely blown away. I abandoned my faith. I was out of the faith for 10 or 12 years. I suppose some people might say that disqualifies me for talking about how to keep your faith while you're in college. But, you know, you learn something from the experience of repenting that and coming back. And I see so many of my own students in the same situation. There are non-churched, non-believing students who are confused about these issues. There are also an awful lot of young Christians, evangelicals and Catholics who hit the university, haven't been prepared for what they're going to encounter there, socially, intellectually, culturally, and are losing their footing. So it seems to me that this is just the thing that we ought to be talking about.
Well, I agree, and that's the sense of urgency. It's hard to know exactly what to do with some of this data, but if you start looking at the studies coming from the Southern Baptist Convention, from evangelical research institutions and evangelical colleges and universities, youth ministries, Campus Crusade, and all the rest, it is clear that a majority of those who, as college freshmen, identify themselves as Christians, a majority consider themselves less Christian when they graduate. Something is happening. What is that?
I think one problem is that we're not doing enough to prepare them, to give them an adult understanding of the faith before they go off to college. You know, often parents will say, "Well, what can I do to prepare my child for going off to college? To prepare my child in the faith?" I say, "Well, of course you should be talking to them about the faith." Surprisingly, in an awful lot of Christian households, Christian families, there is no discussion of this. You assume, well, we go to church. The kids are in Sunday school, or they were when they were younger. There's the youth fellowship. So they've picked up everything that they need to pick up by osmosis, and we never need to talk about it at the home. They know I'm a Christian. That isn't true. You should be talking about these things, making it clear to your kids how central this is to your own life, talking about these things as the Old Testament says, when you're getting up and when you're lying down, when you're going in and when you're and when you're going out, just at every conceivable opportunity. I think another problem is that sometimes when our young people are very small, when they're still children, we teach them the Bible stories, and then when they hit the teenage years, when they're ready to be intellectually challenged, well, they're also full of hormones and they're jumping around and shooting spitwads at each other. And so we sort of give up and we say, well, what they just need is good Christian fellowship. We stop actually teaching them. That's a terrific lost opportunity. It shouldn't surprise us then that they aren't prepared for what they hit at full speed when they get to the college campus.
And what do they hit at full speed?
Well, there are several things that they hit. On the intellectual level, they're hitting worldviews that are opposed to Christianity, sometimes explicitly and obviously opposed, but sometimes it takes a good deal of thought to realize what the conflict, what the tension is. There is naturalism, for instance. You especially encounter that in some of the sciences, the view that material nature is all there is. There is postmodernism, which is... people define it in a lot of different ways, but the simplest definition of postmodernism is that is the view that nothing really hangs together. Truth doesn't hang together. There's just your story or narrative and my story or narrative. That the personality doesn't hang together. My mind, my emotions, my will, these things don't form a whole, and I can't, you know, who I am this week is different than who I was last week. And then there's a sort of a something that I call do-it-yourself spirituality. People mix and match. They take something from the Star Wars movies, something from Wicca, something from something that they've read in Darwin, something from the Bible, and make up their own, what they think is going to be their own faith, but of course it doesn't have any integrity. Now that's at the intellectual level, but culturally there are other problems too. We all know about the temptations of wild living and sex and drugs and all that sort of thing. What's not so often realized is that this comes in a cultural package, and it comes with an intellectual spiel attached. There's an ideology to the temptation itself, which invites us to regard it not as a temptation, but as a view of life or a liberating experience, another way of thinking about the world. And one has to develop the art to see through the smoke, and sometimes just to take a deep breath and blow it away.
I was reading just today a book by Harold T. Shapiro, former president at the University of Michigan at Princeton University. It's entitled A Larger Sense of Purpose, Higher Education and Society. It's kind of his reflections on the experience of being president of two of America's most influential institutions. I was particularly interested in what he would have to say because I was familiar with his role as chairman of the president's Advisory Commission on Bioethics. And also because this is the man who hired Peter Singer to teach bioethics at Princeton University.
Praised him, I believe, as the most influential ethicist alive.
Yes. Now, let me just read to you from his book. This is what he says. He's writing here defending the fact that the university no longer teaches moral character. He says, the greatest source of uneasiness stems from the fear of being perceived as establishing some kind of moral orthodoxy. Many, speaking of faculty, feel it is no longer appropriate for the institution to decide what ethics or whose ethics ought to be taught. Is that even true?
Oh, it's absolutely true. As a matter of fact, if you speak too directly about these matters in class, you're going to come under criticism. You'll be considered an indoctrinator, somebody who is trying to cram your religion or your morality or your views down the students' throats.
But from the other side, I mean, it seems to me that most of the professors I know, Peter Singer, perhaps first and foremost among them, he does have a sense of the good that he wants his students to
have. Of course, those who are tearing down traditional understandings of morality have no inhibition about doing that at all and are not criticized for it.
To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. My guest here in Austin, Texas, is Professor Jay Bujaszewski of the University of Texas. He teaches in the departments of government and philosophy, well-known Christian author and apologist in this age. If you have not read his books, you'll certainly want to get for your own young people the book How to Stay Christian in College. And that's one of the issues we're talking about here today. Just join us by calling 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. This special edition is live from Austin, Texas. I'm Albert Moeller.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program, a special edition today from Austin, Texas. My guest here in the studio, Jay Bujaszewski, who is a professor in the Government and Philosophy Departments at the University of Texas. Professor Bujaszewski, I really enjoy your books, and I must say, you know how to title a book. Your books especially, I enjoy the titles, The Revenge of Conscience, and also the title, What We Can't Not Know. You are arguing a basic Christian principle that there are certain things we really do know, and we're lying to ourselves if we say we don't know them.
Yes, that's right. I think that a lot of Christians, though, are operating under a misunderstanding. They think that it isn't a basic Christian principle. They believe that it is somehow a biblical belief that the only way that you know anything, for instance, about right or wrong, or about whether there is a God, is by reading the Bible. That's not what the Bible itself teaches. It teaches that there is a law written on the heart, that people also learn some things from the consequences of their actions, that there is a harvest for what you sow, that there are some things that we can come to understand from the way that God has designed us, that the very fact that we are designed and that the rest of the universe is designed and that creation testifies to its own creator is a real truth. This is a way that we can understand that there is a God. So I think it's very unbiblical to believe that we can learn things only from the Bible. We learn the plan of salvation only from the revealed Word of God. But the whole universe conspires by God's providence, by God's design, to teach us something about Him and His reality, and to plant longings for Him in our hearts.
And particular moral knowledge.
And
I'm speaking here as a Reformed theologian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I am from the side of evangelical Protestantism that wants to point specifically to biblical authority and to sola scriptura. And I've been well known in public arguments against the utilization of mere natural law reasoning in moral debates. Mm-hmm. But I want to come back and say that the Reformer certainly believed in the natural law and in this innate knowledge, this moral consciousness. And I do as well. And I think we always have to keep in mind, not only do we have this testimony to the fact that God has made us in His image, but we also have the warning that Paul gives us in Romans chapter 2 that the conscience can come to be, well, rather thoroughly corrupted.
It can come to be corrupted. The way in which that happens is often misunderstood. People think, well, when he speaks about the darkening of our minds, that he must mean that we lose our consciences, that they are destroyed. Or when elsewhere the New Testament speaks of the consciences of some people becoming seared, we think that means that they're killed. No, they're not. It's not killed. It's pushed underground. We lie to ourselves. We tell ourselves that we don't know what we really do, so that most of what passes itself off as moral confusion, moral ignorance, when we say to ourselves, well, I'm trying to do the right thing, but it's so unclear. Everything is shades of gray. I'm walking through the fog. Most of that is really self-deception. We know what is right and wrong, but we're in denial.
What is it that we can't not know?
Well, in the first place, we can't not know I would say the privileged expression of what we can't not know morally is the Ten Commandments. But I mean the Ten Commandments not just as you read them in the Bible. The person who's never heard of the Bible has some intimation of these truths, too. And I also mean the Ten Commandments not just by themselves, but together with the things that they presuppose, and together with the things that they imply, and together with the things that they suggest. For instance, if you're going to say that that you ought to be faithful to your spouse, if we are commanded not to commit adultery, that presupposes that there is an institution of marriage. Everybody knows about this. The Hottentots know about this. The Inuit know about this. South Sea Islanders know about this. If you're going to say that that you should be faithful to your spouse, that also suggests, although it doesn't explicitly state, a broader conception of sexual purity, because you have to say, well, why is this important in the first place? These are all things that we know. Some of them we know very clearly. Some of them we just have intuitions about that encourage us to explore further.
You know, the Bible teaches us that one of the effects of sin is self-deception. We literally hide knowledge from ourselves that is altogether there. And the first, I think, issue of that knowledge is the fact that we are a creature, and that
yes,
we are indeed not autonomous. We are not self-defining. We are not self-explanatory. When we come back, I'm going to be talking with Professor Buzyrzewski about what it means to be human, because that is one of the big issues of debate today, of course, not only in philosophy, but in the real world of bioethics and medical decisions. Back with that conversation in just a moment, live from Austin, Texas. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. This is the 20th anniversary of the publication of Alan Bloom's seminal book, The Closing of the American Mind. It began with one of the best written, most memorable lines in all of recent American literature. He says, "The one thing every college student knows or thinks he knows is that all truth is relative." That was 20 years ago. My guest today is Professor Jay Buzyrzewski of the University of Texas. Would you say that is still true of the average university student today?
Oh, yes, I would say it is still true. There is one difference, though. University students today, at least in my own experience, are more open to talking about how lost they feel about all this. 20 years ago, when I came to the university, it was that the universe is all meaningless, values are all relative, there's no right and wrong, isn't it cool? And now it's the world is meaningless, values are relative, etc., etc., and I'm miserable.
Now, that's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
In what sense are they miserable?
Well, I'll give you an example. Because of the things that I teach, because of the classical authors that I teach, certain questions are going to come up. One day, the sexual revolution came up in class. And I said to the students, I said, my sense of the matter is this. Tell me if I'm right. My generation invented the sexual revolution, but yours seems to be paying the price. A young man spoke up and he said, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. He said, I really want to fall in love with a woman and be faithful to her and marry her and stay faithful to her to the rest of my life. And then my heart soared, but then he broke it because he said, but I don't think it's possible. He said, because my parents couldn't put it together.
You know, I recently linked to an article and discussed it on the air from a young man at another university who was writing. He said, let's just call ourselves Generation D, the divorce generation. We're the generation whose parents taught us that nothing lasts.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and that's left such a terrible scar because these young people, they want things to last, but they're convinced that they don't last and try to reconcile themselves to that fact. That's what the hooking up culture is all about. It isn't that anybody really enjoys this, but it's that they're convinced that the alternative is not possible. It's nihilistic sex. It's a sex of despair. It's not a sex with never the ghost of a hope, but it's the sex of hopes that that people think that they're crazy to entertain and that they have to somehow try to banish from their hearts.
I mentioned earlier this book by Harold T. Shapiro, former president at Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
He's arguing for moral pluralism, and this is one line. He says, we must recognize that contemporary Western culture is characterized by a bewildering kaleidoscope of identities, ethnicities, values, and cosmologies that are certain to generate a persistent array of tensions. Now, what he's talking about here is the fact that, and he admits, by the way, that the university and the culture were established in a very consistent and well-understood Christian worldview.
Sure.
Not to say that all were regenerate Christians, but the worldview of the early college was undeniably Christian.
Yeah.
And he suggests that the worldview, that the modern university now doesn't have a worldview. That just doesn't seem plausible to me.
I don't think that it's true that it doesn't have a worldview. You find the same thing not just about the university, but about anybody who says that he has a new worldview, or that he's agnostic about the great questions of life, about what is good, about whether there is a God. agnosticism in practice is always atheism. You know, if you really didn't know, then you might either live as though there were a God and a right and a wrong, or you might live as though there were no God and no right and no wrong. We always choose the second alternative, not the first, so that agnosticism turns out to be practical atheism.
You know, it strikes me that that is a big difference, because in the early 20th century, you had people like Evelyn Waugh and others, you know, persons of letters, who really were encouraging that even if God is dead, we should live as if he's alive.
Yes.
But there is a big change now.
Every now and then you still find cultural figures, Christians always, for instance, Benedict XVI has suggested to non-believers in Europe that that's exactly what they should do. He says, if you don't believe in God, try the experiment of living as though there were a God, and you may be surprised as to what happens. And that does make sense to some people. Some people will still listen because the alternative has become so empty they can't make sense of their lives anymore.
The spectrum of American academic life ranges from the community college all the way to small liberal arts colleges, Christian colleges. Then you have large private universities, and of course the great public universities, such as the University of Texas, highly involved in research, research being the great impetus in the late 19th century toward building these institutions. There are now so many ethical questions involved with this. What about the issues of something like human cloning? Where does this fit in both to the idea that there are things we can't not know, and to this claim that the university is really not morally responsible for coming up with any kind of definition of what it means to be human?
Well, I tell you, we are, one of the things that you can't not know is that we are not just what's, we are who's, that there's a fundamental difference between us and the material world. But it's easy to lose sight of that. There's a sort of a dim awe that attaches to reflecting on human life, on what it is to be a human being, and the non-believer feels that too. He perceives that. Even an atheist recognizes some mystery here. Now, is that recognition of a mystery, is that awe, is that sense of something that if you were a believer that you'd call sacred, is that enough to take you to the recognition that we are made in the image of God? No, it isn't. But if you are told, you know, there's a reason for why you think that, why you seem to perceive that mystery, it is because we are made in the image of God, it makes sense of all of it. It puts it into perspective. And so that sometimes makes the conversation possible. If you reject that, though, and we're not like the pagans, a culture that has never heard that we are made in the image of God, we are rather a culture that has heard but has refused to listen to it anymore, then you're really in trouble, because human beings, just like everything else, will merely be stuff to be manipulated. If I can manipulate human beings who are microscopically small for the sake of cures, well, why not do it? You know, it's difficult for people to remind themselves of what they really do know, but are desperately trying not to think about.
Yeah, just using your dichotomy here, it's really clear that perhaps even a majority of Americans consider the embryo a what rather than a who.
Well, and that's connected with the fact that it's getting harder and harder for us to even think of ourselves as who's rather than just what's.
This is a fascinating conversation, and we'll be back to continue it in just a moment. When we come back, I'm going to be asking Professor Buzyshevsky about just where we stand on some of the most crucial issues as they're playing out on America's university campuses. The University of Texas is a great state institution. As a matter of fact, one of America's largest state universities, and one of the most respected. It's a place where the clash of worldviews is being lived out every moment of every day. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Yesterday we were discussing the issue of homosexuality, Michael Kinsley's argument that we're just on the wrong side of history. We were also looking at the Boston Globe magazine article about gay teenagers in Massachusetts saying they never came out of the closet because there never was a closet they ever felt themselves to be in. Professor Buzyshevsky, is that what it's like on the major college campuses today?
I think it is pretty much like that. I've had some some startling experiences in the classroom. It used to be that the big hot button issue, the thing that would get people very angry and shouting at each other, was abortion. A surprising number of my students think abortion is wrong, but will say, "But if I needed one, I'd have one," and they don't really want to think about it. What gets people angry now is not so much abortion as homosexuality. And even most of my evangelical Christian students are very confused about this. A large part of it is that unfortunately a lot of our Christian students aren't behaving that much differently than their secular counterparts. If you won't draw the line properly in the life of your own heterosexuality, how can you be expected to draw a line concerning a disordered impulse like homosexual desire? You can't be. If you are doing what you know to be wrong in your heterosexual life, then your own conscience is, in a perverse sort of way, going to forbid you from making judgments of other people, because you know that you're painting the same judgment of yourself.
You'll want to know about Professor Bujaszewski's books. They include Written on the Heart, The Case for Natural Law, The Revenge of Conscience, Politics and the Fall of Man, What We Can't Not Know, and two books that I think are particularly interesting for some college students and some parents. You may want to give these to high school students as well, entitled How to Stay Christian in College, and the second one is Ask Me Anything, at least the first volume. And this is compiled of columns Professor Bujaszewski had written for Boundless.org, one of our favorite websites where I also write, and he has a regular column there.
It's actually moved. It's at True You, which is maintained by the same organization, Focus on the Family. But now it's at TrueU.org.
Thank you for that clarification. You'll want to find it there. And frankly, you're going to want to find Dr. Bujaszewski's books. And I hope you will help others to find them as well. You know, just taking the title, that one book, How to Stay Christian in College, that is one of the great challenges of this generation. And I'm particularly thankful that that someone like Professor Bujaszewski is teaching here at the University of Texas. And it is a reminder to us that we as Christians bear the stewardship of the mind and the stewardship of the teaching vocation. We need to honor those who are doing it so well and so faithfully. Back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation, Coast to Coast. This is the Albert Miller Program. And thanks today to Hyde Park Baptist Church here in Austin, Texas, for hosting us for this program. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.